This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. When Alan Page was a star defensive tackle for the Minnesota Vikings in the 1970s, he was also attending law school full-time. He went on to become Minnesota's first African-American Supreme Court justice. Next Monday, Justice Page will be the keynote speaker at the annual La Crosse area Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration. I recently talked with the Hall of Fame defensive lineman from his office in St. Paul. I asked Justice Page to preview what he will be talking about during his speech Monday night at Viterbo University's Fine Arts Center.
Generally, I'm going to be reflecting on issues of race, which seem to me to be a natural discussion point when talking about Dr. King. And I think tied into that, how we deal with issues of race, how race impacts us, the impact that our education system, the implications of that in race, the importance of ensuring that every child, no matter what race, ethnicity, what background they come from, that they be given the best possible opportunity to learn, not just for their benefit, but because children really are the future.
And I want to talk about your education foundation in a little bit, but do you think that our society currently does a good job talking about race?
Not at all. We basically don't talk about race, and when we do, we talk around it, we talk by it, we don't engage it directly. We don't talk much about how we deal with issues of race. We point fingers, we complain about someone said A, B, or C, but we don't get much beyond that.
In your mind, if someone was to talk about race and beyond the presentation you'll be giving, you know, what sort of elements should people have when they do have a discussion about race? Because, you know, sometimes you have people who are scared they're going to be offensive, or some may say they're being too blunt, you know, and it's just interesting because it doesn't seem like anyone seems to really know. How can we properly talk about race?
Well, I focused on talking about it, but really the question is, what do we do about it? And I think from my experience and from my sense, what we have to do about it first is look internally and understand our own views, our own actions, our own conduct as it relates to race, ensure that we as individuals are accepting people as they are, not as some preconceived notion of what we think they should be based on their race. We have to look at the individual and make determinations about the individual and not about the group. It seems to me that when we do that, then the conversation becomes at least one where we're all operating sort of from the same perspective. That is, from the perspective of, you know, I'm sensitive to these issues. I care about these issues, and I'm going to make sure that whatever I do, say, act, however I act, I do it consciously and not unconsciously.
At this annual celebration, it's a celebration that highlights some positive efforts in the community, but there's generally some challenges that are addressed and different speakers that challenge people to improve themselves, but also just to improve as a community. So it will be interesting, I think, for people to hear your thoughts and how you challenge people to behave differently.
I'm a firm believer that each of us and all of us have the ability to bring about change, and that, as I say, that change begins with us. And when we all engage in that, I think it's surprising how things can and do change.
I wonder, Justice Page, did you ever have a chance to meet Dr. King?
I never did. No, I did not.
And, you know, during the mid-60s, I guess you were studying, you were playing football at the University of Notre Dame, you were studying political science. Were you involved in politics or the civil rights movement during the 60s?
Not directly. Certainly, I was involved in it from the standpoint that as an African-American male, you couldn't help be concerned and voice your opinions, but in a public way, no.
Have you ever considered yourself an advocate?
An advocate?
Of civil rights. I've always been curious how, especially someone like a Supreme Court justice is able to walk that fine line between law and advocacy, especially when it comes to issues like civil rights.
Well, the role that our courts play, I guess let me put it this way. I'm an advocate for equal justice. And in a judicial system, both at the state level and on the national level, that has not always provided equal justice for persons of color, I guess in that sense, I probably am an advocate. And when I say equal justice, I mean equal justice for all, no matter who you are, no matter where you come from, no matter what your background is, whether you're rich or poor, whether you're a person of color or not, whether you're abled or disabled, whatever your background, you come into our court system and you're entitled to equal justice. And we've done some studies here in Minnesota and other states around the country have that show categorically that equal justice has not always been available to persons of color.
Do you think that that's improving? I know we have a long way to go. I guess I'll say that.
That's the point. Obviously, we've made great strides. We no longer have state-sponsored apartheid. Brown versus the Board of Education started us down the road in the legal sense of equality. But we've got a long, long way to go. And particularly in our judicial system. And we've made some progress there, but we still have a long way to go.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Justice Alan Page. He's an Associate Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court, as well as a celebrated National Football League Hall of Famer. He'll be the keynote speaker at the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration at Viterbo University on January 20th. I wonder if now is a good time to talk about education. This is obviously something extremely important to you. In some ways, it is a social justice issue.
Well, it is directly tied to race.
Sure.
The failures of our education system as it relates to children of color is astounding. And it's on some levels disheartening because education is the one tool, or is not the one tool, but is one tool that can allow anyone to overcome the disadvantages that come with being a person of color, that manifest themselves with respect to race. Education is a tool that will allow you to overcome poverty, will assist you in overcoming discrimination. It is just one of those things that will allow everyone to be full participants in our society. And when we leave so many children behind, and not just children of color, but lots of children from all backgrounds, but particularly disproportionately, I should say, children of color, it's a major problem.
And we're still seeing huge achievement gaps, not just here in Wisconsin, not just in
Minnesota
but across
the nation.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But you and your wife, Diane, have set up one tool to at least try to address the disparities the two of you established the Page Education Foundation in 1988. I'm wondering if you can talk about that, and you just celebrated your 25th anniversary last year. So maybe why you decided to start that foundation and maybe where you're at now.
Well, the reason we decided to start it comes out of our belief that education is one of those tools that can help anyone succeed. My recognition a long time ago that many of the problems we see in the conflict between athletics and academics are really academic problems and not athletic problems. Coupled with my legal background and defending when I was in practice, being involved in either defending state agencies or bringing discrimination claims, and seeing the role that education played in all that, seeing the role that education plays with respect to our prison population. There's a direct correlation between educational achievement and incarceration rates. And it seems to me that we can do something about that, and we can do better than what we've done. So we decided, from the time I started playing football as a freshman in high school, I'd been put on this pedestal and been asked to talk to young children about the importance of education. As a football player, I'm one person can reach only so many people. And we came up with the idea that if we could finance the education of many young people, they could become advocates for education. And so we came up with the idea to motivate, encourage, and assist young men and women of color to pursue their education beyond high school. We do that two ways. One, by providing financial assistance. We call them paid scholars. We provide renewable financial grants. But two, we require our grant recipients to go back into the community where they come from, back into the community where they go to school, work with young children kindergarten through eighth grade, specifically in the area of education, as tutors, mentors, and role models. That way, we can expand the impact. Not only that, we can show those kindergarten through eighth graders by both word and deed of our paid scholars, someone who is using education as a tool to achieve their hopes and dreams, and thereby inspire those young children to take education seriously.
And have many of those younger children gone on to receive Page Education Foundation scholarships once they've graduated high school?
We have big goals and objectives, and we do a lot. We have, over the years, we're approaching something in excess of 6,000 paid scholars, but we only have 3 employees at the foundation, and so we haven't tracked that as well as we could. We've had some paid scholars who were former, who've been mentored by paid scholars, but we have, as I say, over the years, 6,000 plus young men and women who have been an inspiration for those young children. And I think it's pretty clear that whether people who have been mentored by scholars or tutored by scholars, whether or not they someday become scholars, that they are impacted by our scholars.
6,000 students, that's a gigantic impact, I would think.
Exactly. And, you know, you multiply just being very conservative. If I can reach 10 students, you know, 6,000 people can reach 60,000 students. And the multiplier effect is tremendous.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Justice Alan Page has served on the Minnesota Supreme Court since 1993. This came after a 15-year pro football career. And he'll be in La Crosse on January 20th as the keynote speaker at this year's Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration at Viterbo University. I'm wondering, Justice Page, what are some of the other major civil rights or social justice issues today, in your mind, beyond education?
The ones that were there 30 years ago, we still have tremendous issues with discrimination that impacts the disabled. Clearly, the hot topic of the day is sexual orientation discrimination. There are still issues of age discrimination. Sadly, as I say, we've made progress. I don't mean to suggest that we haven't made tremendous progress. We have, but we've still got so very, very far to go.
And what role does a state Supreme Court play in addressing these issues?
When cases come before us, we have to sort out what the rules, if you will, that we're going to play by are. Those cases, those kinds of cases are in front of us all the time. It's important that as judges, justices on the Supreme Court, that we do everything we can to ensure that the case that comes in front of us is dealt with fairly, properly, and so that our decisions can be accepted by the people who they impact, and they impact all of us. And I should note that in talking about the civil rights issues of our time, we are still dealing with issues of gender discrimination. They haven't gone away either.
One thing that I found very interesting about you and race and your family is I had read an article about how you and your wife have a collection of Jim Crow era memorabilia. And one of the things that it said in this article was that you want to be constantly reminded about the past. Can you talk about that? And do you still have all that memorabilia in your family living room?
I have some of it here in my chambers.
What do you have in your chambers?
I'm looking at a sign that says colored waiting room. It wasn't so long ago that those signs, those kinds of signs, hung in restaurants, in stores, in train stations. And I don't think we can afford to forget that, to recognize that as a society, we have not always treated all of our members fairly. And so for me, this is a reminder as I go through the work that I do to make sure that I do treat everyone fairly, whether they're a person of color or not, whether they're wealthy or not, you know, wherever they come from. Everybody is entitled to the same treatment.
Beyond being a reminder to yourself, do you feel like others have maybe learned a lesson from the collection that you own?
The collection isn't on display, so I don't know how many people have seen it, but certainly it is a reminder for all of us.
Alan Page is an Associate Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court, as well as celebrated National Football League Hall of Famer. He's a keynote speaker at the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration at Viterbo University on January 20th. Justice Page, I want to finally just ask you, how familiar are you with the Wisconsin Supreme Court and its elections? Some consider this a social justice issue in its own sense, the way that money has played a role in elections here, and some say special interest groups are having more of an influence in elections than they should. Do you follow what's going on here in Wisconsin, and do you feel that Minnesota experiences similar issues?
I won't pick on my friends from Wisconsin, but I will say that it is an issue that we here in Minnesota face. We don't face it in the same way, at least currently, that they do in Wisconsin. And it's not just a Wisconsin issue. It's an issue across the country that there are those who want to be able to buy justice, if you will. They want to be able to buy results. That is something that is anathema to a democracy. If the people we serve think that justice is for sale, that our decisions are predicated on the highest bidder, then they have no reason to bring their disputes to court. They can just as well decide them in the streets. Ultimately, it is an issue that will determine how well our democracy survives, how we deal with the influence of money and the judicial selection process. And quite frankly, it's very challenging. Not remembering precisely, I think it was Alabama, it might have been Mississippi, but I think it was the 2008 election cycle. There was some organization from Virginia that spent roughly $815,000 either the Alabama or Mississippi Supreme Court election. What some organization from Virginia, what interest they might have in a Alabama or Mississippi election, I don't know. But I don't think they spent that money out of the kindness of their hearts. That's a problem. That is a problem. They say if people perceive that we are open to the highest bidder, we're all in trouble.
Alan Page is a Pro Football Hall of Famer and Minnesota's first African-American Supreme Court justice. He will be the keynote speaker Monday night at La Crosse's annual Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration. The event starts at 7 at Viterbo University's Fine Arts Center. The event is free and open to the public. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, we'll talk about Sunday's move into a new hospital wing at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Archives of this and other recent editions of Newsmakers, extended interviews, and photos can be found on our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You can also like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Gunderson Health System opens a new hospital this weekend. It's a culmination of years of planning and a remake of Gunderson's La Crosse Medical Campus. Here to talk about the opening of the legacy building are Mason Quackenbush, the operational project manager for campus renewal, and Gunderson CEO, Dr. Jeff Thompson. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis asked Dr. Thompson why a new hospital wing is needed.
The board, looking at this a number of years ago, tried to balance the cost of an activity like this with the cost of renovating the very old facility that we're working in. Our staff has done a marvelous job developing, delivering great outcomes, great patient satisfaction, great caring, but the state, the Joint Commission, a variety of people are saying, boy, this building is really outdated. This facility needs to be upgraded. And the cost of that was so high. It's just like with your personal car. At some point, you just say, boy, I'm throwing a lot of money into something that there isn't much left here. So the board felt that this was the right time. It's been talked about for 20 years that this was the right time.
Mason, what has been involved in planning this move?
You could probably break it into three different sections. The actual design, going back to a lot of the history that Dr. Thompson was talking about, then the construction, and then the work that I've really been a part of is the operational planning. And I've been a part of the project for probably 3.5-4 years now, and it's a culmination of work tied back to everything from education and training to the route planning we're going to move patients from the Heritage Building into the Legacy, but then also the routes that go on once we occupy the space. Technology has been huge. Communication has been huge. There's a lot of work that's gone in on the unit-based planning. As Dr. Thompson referenced, the older space that we were working in was not necessarily efficient. In 1960s, 1970s, we didn't have the technology we have today. You look at simple amenities like a blanket warmer, ice maker. We didn't have those back then on every unit. So they weren't necessarily positioned in ideal locations. They're in locations where we had spaces. So we've been able to go in the design phase and actually put them in logical places that create efficiency for our staff. Now the change becomes, how do you operationalize that? I'm used to going to this location for my medications and this location for my ice maker and blanket warmer. And even though it may make a lot more sense, it's a major change for our staff to adjust to say, okay, I need to reroute this way. This is where I go to my workstation. This is where I go for the supply. And it completely changes the dynamics of the workflow. So it's been a lot of work to get them comfortable, number one, with the space, the size, the change, but then the workflow of going into that new space and saying, all right, I need to be comfortable day one moving in there. And we've got a lot of training going on this week to do that.
I know you haven't been in the building that long, but has there been a chance for staff to get acclimated?
For the last 2 years, we've been taking staff through just about every Friday. And we've been able to first acclimate them to the space. Our biggest challenge, number one, was just getting them orientated. It's a big space. It's a different shape, different configuration. So that was our first goal, get them in and eliminate that wow factor that, wow, this is a lot bigger than what I've been used to. Once that occurred, then we allowed them to get in and do a little bit more workflow planning to identify the time that it's going to take from checking in and going to the lounge and then going out of the unit. And over the last probably 4 months, 6 months, we've really allowed more in-depth planning. We've allowed restricted access with certain people to get in and really guide and escort them once they get onto the floors. But probably 2 to 3 weeks before Christmas, they really spent a lot of time doing vendor-led education. So all of our new technologies, the new nurse call system, the real-time location system that allows us to track some of our equipment and also identify when certain roles enter a room, as well as our Get Well Network, which is our patient education system. So we needed to do some more in-depth training on those. And that occurred over a two-week period. We had about 1,000 people go through that training in our new building. And we wanted to make sure that it was done in our new space as opposed to training in conference rooms or classrooms. And then over the last week, we've really, since January 2nd, done an in-depth with what we're calling mock operations, and that includes everything from scavenger hunts to actual mock scenarios if there was a medical code of some sort, and just transporting patients with kind of our existing process and trying to figure out those new routes and get people comfortable. We've had an advantage of getting in the building, getting the space up until it was probably October. I think we had to have hard hats and vests and everything else, so it really limited the amount of time we could spend in there. But our staff really became comfortable, and we've really seen a shift from that anxiety or the nervousness about the space and size to really this enthusiasm and excitement.
Is everything new in the building?
We got in some new space, but we really wanted to be fiscally responsible, and unless something was towards the end of its life, we are moving most of our equipment, most of our beds. In fact, the patients will all move in their beds from the Heritage Hospital to the Legacy Hospital. And in some cases, we had to get new equipment because we added different procedure rooms, things like that. But we did our best to really make sure that we got the life out of our equipment and moved it over. That actually creates a lot of challenge to our move process because, as you can imagine, a lot of that equipment, a lot of the supplies are critical to the patient care. And how we time that move is very important. So we don't want our staff to be without certain pieces of equipment over an extended period of time. So we've timed them out pretty good to make sure that they have only a few hours for certain things or a few days for other items.
So there is a comfort level with much of the equipment.
Absolutely.
Are there new technologies that staff will have to be acclimated to? And how is that education piece going?
Yeah, so I referenced three of them, the Get Well Network, the nurse call system, and then what we call our RTLS system, real-time location system. It's probably some of the simplest user-friendly technology, but it is a change. It's a change of the way we've done things. For example, our nurse call system and our RTLS system work together. So with the new nurse call system, I may have the option to press a pain button, a water button, a toilet button, or the general nurse call button instead of just one. That then sends a text to our nursing staff or our CNAs, providing them with that text saying water room 5735 or whatever it might be. And then that will escalate if the response isn't there because our staff do get busy. So it will not end with one text. Then they can respond with the right person providing the right care. As the nurse or the CNA enters that room based on the RTLS system, that nurse call light will be deactivated. It actually knows what role has entered the room, saving a step from having the nurse or CNA having to shut that light off. The Get Well Network is also a big change. As we look for providers that could get us our television system, so movies on demand, games on demand, the Get Well Network kind of surfaced, and it's an awesome solution because their emphasis is on education. So it completely changes the way we deliver education to our patients at discharge, at admission, before a surgery or procedure. And it's all through television in the room with either a remote or portable keyboard. It's very intuitive. They've got a range of options. So you can have pediatric education. You could have geriatric education. And our nursing staff had to be trained on all of that to get comfortable with that system. That's been one of the interesting things to watch, too. A lot of nervousness as they got into that. Well, I'm not sure I want to change how I've done things. And the more they see it and the easier they see it is to work with, it's going to be a great win for our patients and our staff.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We are talking about the opening of a new hospital wing at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse with CEO Dr. Jeff Thompson and Mason Quackenbush. He's the operational project manager for campus renewal. Dr. Thompson, ultimately, patients need to see the benefit of this. And what is the benefit for patients?
They will feel that despite being surrounded by all the great technology that Mason has talked about, they will feel more private but secure and warm. And we have, you know, an outdoor terrace that today might not get used a lot, but an outdoor terrace where patients and families can go and get some fresh air, big windows that look out onto the bluffs or the river valley. There are many opportunities where family will be able to be right next to the patient, but out of the staff's way while the staff is taking care of the patient. This allows the family to be engaged, but not feeling like they're in the way. I think the patients, whether they're coming in on helicopter and land on the roof and then go directly to whatever floor they need to go to, or coming into the ambulance bay where multiple ambulances at a time can come inside and drop off their patients, they will feel like they are in a not a fancy place, but a nice place that is warm and conducive to making them and their family more comfortable and heal more quickly.
One of the things we really emphasized in the design was the patient and family-centered care. And so if you're familiar with the Disney World, it's a similar concept with the onstage and offstage. So what do our family members, what do our patients actually need to see? And we've got two different hallways, one where staff, one where the behind-the-scenes things will occur, the laundry delivery, the garbage pickup, our dietary aids delivering carts through those halls. And are those things that our patients and families need to see on a day-to-day basis? We have nurse servers, which allow us to stock the rooms from the outside as opposed to the inside. The second thing is really the logic that went into the design. As Dr. Thompson referenced earlier, we have buildings on our campus dating back to 1917. As you build adjacent buildings and add adjacent buildings and keep adding them over nearly 100 years, you lose a lot of the logic that goes into how do I enter the facility and get from point A to point B. For the first time in the history of our building, we have a circle drive that will connect our emergency room entrance, our hospital entrance, and our clinic entrance. So even if you go to the wrong location, it's connected all by a concourse, and you can physically see where you need to go. Our elevator bank, once you walk into the facility, you can see it physically. You can walk to it and get to it without having to walk down a line. Our waiting areas are in close proximity to the units. You don't have to follow a purple line. We've made the best out of what we've had, but when you have those buildings that are built adjacent over time, you lose a lot of that connection, that feel. With the healing environment, it's provided a lot of logic. Our surgical waiting area is in very close proximity to the healing garden, close proximity to the library, the gift shop, other areas. So as a family member, I'm very nervous to leave that area. I don't want to go too far away because I'm afraid I might not get a call or whatever, I can leave, come right back. It's right there. It's very visible to me.
My understanding is the emergency room and the critical care units in the new location are going to be much improved over the current situation. Could you speak to that, please?
One of the things that's very important in this day and age is to be able to use your technology as a tool and not have it as an impediment or a complicating factor that doesn't help us. And we believe with the new design in the emergency response area, we'll have it set up so if it's more minor issues, they can be triaged to urgent care, and if it's more major, it can be managed in the emergency area, and if it's huge traumas or tough problems, there are specialty design rooms for that as well. In the critical care area, also more equipment, more ill patients who are very, very ill than in the past, and they require more staff and more support around them. These areas will allow us to provide that care. I think a great example in between those two areas is the operating rooms, where in the operating room, in the handle of the major light over the surgical table itself, there's a camera. And the camera can be turned on or off, however we decide. But if you're operating in one room and you want to ask me a question and I'm in another room or in another part of the organization or over in the educational center, the ICE house, that camera can be turned on and we can look at what's going on there to say, here's how we need to do this here. What do you think? What should we do next? Here's an issue. This is a new problem. What do you think? Or you can use it to train other staff. The technology is used as a tool to improve the health and well-being of the patients by making communication better, making the staff more efficient, having them focus on the patient and not all the equipment, the clutter, and the things around them.
How many beds were there in the old facility, and how many will there be in the new facility?
It would seem like it's a pretty straightforward question, and I can tell you that the most straightforward answer is about the same. Most hospitals are licensed, so we're licensed for 325 beds. Most hospitals are licensed for a certain number of beds for emergencies and things like that, and then actually have 250-ish that they actually staff. There's going to be a few more beds added to the emergency department, for example, but for the most part, this was not an expansion of beds. It was expansion of rooms because we went from 37% shared rooms to now in all the whole new part of the hospital, there will be no shared rooms. They're all individual rooms. So we expand the number of rooms, but the overall bed capacity, the trends in the country are to not have patients in the hospital as much as we used to. So we're not trying to get bigger and bigger. We're trying to deliver a higher level of the care to those patients that have to come to the hospital.
People don't want to share rooms these days when they go to the hospital, do they?
No, and if you've had a loved one in the hospital or been in the hospital yourself and experienced that, it is quite the experience. You have one patient wanting to watch Judge Judy, the other wanting to have some quiet peace with a private conversation with a family member. You have a clinician coming to the room and a nurse coming to the other. You have a crowded room already with just two guests. You have a divider in the curtain. And as our society has progressed, it's really about that individual room and the private nature of healthcare. Now, in a few areas, we have added space, added items, amenities that we didn't have before, such as bereavement rooms, grieving rooms. We have more sub-wait areas in our emergency services area. In the case of an emergency, a critical ill patient, family members need a place to congregate. And so we've provided additional space for that. In our pre-op areas, we've also added more space. Right now we have, I believe, 12 rooms for a pre-op, and we're growing to 44. They're small rooms. They share a bathroom, but you have your own private room, and you can come and go into those rooms once you arrive for surgery and when you leave from surgery. The trend is really shifting away from those shared rooms, and the model even, I guess, in the 50s, 60s was still the ward style. In the 70s and the 80s, there were a number of facilities built, a couple in the cities that had rings or towers. They were built with a nursing station in the middle with rooms on the outside in the circle. They had three patients in a room. Well, to convert those rooms to single occupancy now, you now have only 12 rooms or whatever on a floor, and it really becomes inefficient. So the design or the model is shifting more to those private rooms, the single occupancy, and I think that our new space allows us to really provide better care with the single room.
I know staffing is often at a premium in the healthcare these days. I know Gunderson has not always been staffed at full staff in the current hospital. Will you be at full staff or close to full staff in the new facility?
We're fine with staff. We for the last several years, we've been able to recruit amazing young group of very capable nurses, respiratory therapists, a variety of caregivers out of school, but also have been able to keep a hold of some senior folks. We have people coming in. I mean, we had 500 or 600 openings last year across the organization, and had I think 18,000 applications for that. So we're doing fine on the staffing.
Our vacancy rate is usually much better than national averages. What this will allow us to do, though, is really recruit ourselves without having to do much work. We already had a number of candidates express interest from the local universities. They want to get in and work in a new facility, the new technologies, the new amenities. A lot of what Dr. Thompson has implemented, as well as the green initiatives, we have people from across the country who have heard of us and interested in working in a green organization.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking about the opening of a new hospital wing at Gunderson Lutheran in La Crosse with Mason Quackenbush. He's the Operational Project Manager for Campus Renewal, and Dr. Jeff Thompson. He is CEO, and the move is scheduled for this coming weekend. You mentioned the green aspect. This building continues the direction that Gunderson Lutheran has been going?
It starts with the basic design. The basic design of the facility is over twice as efficient for heat and power as other even new hospitals, let alone the old, very energy consumptive hospital. Healthcare in general is 2.5 times more energy consumptive than other buildings for a variety of reasons. But one of the reasons they haven't paid attention to it over the years. And we worked with a group of architects and planners and engineers, and this will start out being remarkably more efficient from the beginning in how it was designed and how it's organized. And then, we're pretty proud to say our commitment is to the health and well-being of the local communities and the local economy. So all the trying to keep our costs down and those kinds of things that we do, but this building will save us several $100,000 every single year in energy costs. And then the energy costs that we do have will all go into the local economy. So as opposed to years past where you get your power from the power plant that generated the power from coal from Wyoming, and you get your heat from natural gas that came from the gas fields in Texas, we will get our power and our heat from local sources. So we have a biomass boiler that's burning hardwood chips. We have a geothermal field that's taking heat and cooling out of the ground. Our board said, is there an initial investment in these things? Yes, but long term, it's a great investment for not only the finances of the organization, but the finances of the community. It'll be less pollution, less things that will cause health issues in the community. We will save money as an organization, and we will have a healthier community and a more robust stimulus to the economy of the region.
So how much is this building project, and how is it being funded?
Actually, it's free. If you do this in this year, it's no. To do something like this right, it does cost money. And now we're back to our analogy of the car. At some point, fixing up your old car is almost as expensive as new car payments. I can tell you that the cost of the building is less than 1% of our budget over the next 25 years. So this building is going to last 50, 80, 100 years. But if you only look at the next 25, it's less than 1% of our budget. It isn't the cause of driving up the cost of health care. We believe it'll help us keep our 13-year track record of fee increases being less than the year before. This is going to help us keep that. I think another important piece is to remember that at the time of its opening, we'll have over half of the building costs, over half of the building costs covered by either philanthropic pledges or just the fiscal discipline of the organization from savings that we've had. In the end, it is hard to, you know, people keep wanting to put a number on the cost of the building. I mean, do you count the streets or not the streets? Do you count the furnace? Do you count the electronics that are in it? If you buy a house, you don't count the big screen TV you put in the basement. It's hard to get through all that. But to put it in a context, it's less than 1% of our budget over the next 25 years. And of that big number, that number is even half of that's already paid for. So it's really of what's left to be paid for, it's less than a half a percent of the budget over the next 25 years. So we believe we're being very fiscally sound. And our board, that's, you know, it's a community-led board. We looked at this very hard. And when we did the AdMeUp, it added up as a net positive for the community as opposed to a negative.
So how much is the building and how is it being funded?
So we haven't released how much the building is because the building is a complex thing of renovation and all these deals. Mm-hmm. How it's being funded is pretty straightforward, that over half of the building is philanthropy and savings that we had. The other about half is borrowed. So some is from money from the past, some is donated, and some we'll pay over time. We thought that is a good mix of how we spread out the cost.
So how has the fundraising piece gone? I mean, you're building this in the middle of not the best of economic times.
We looked at that, John, pretty hard, and that was a big question. What would we do? And we had outside folks come in, and the outside folks and people looking at it said, well, you know, if you could raise $25 million, that would be, boy, that'd be top end, because nobody's raised, really collected more than $17, $18 million in the community for any fundraising ever. They said that would be amazing. We already have around $20 million in the door, okay, that's already been paid. We have pledges and money paid already that are in the $46, $47 million range. We have a number of other individuals who we believe can make significant donations who are still talking with us about being a part of this great gift to the community. So our fundraising more than doubled what the experts thought could even be possible. We have over 4,000 people from the community, led by many of our staff, 1,000 of our employees, over 350 of our physicians. I mean, huge outpouring of our own staff to say, yes, we're going to support this effort. A couple thousand people from the community in general. And then from those who have the most information, who are own businesses and are important part of the philanthropic community, for the first time ever in this part of the state, we have 14 individuals, families, or businesses that have given $1 million or more. That is a huge trust that they have placed in our staff in delivering this outstanding level of care.
So the movie is coming this Sunday. How are you expecting it to go?
It will go well. We move patients every single day, so that's not new to us. We just haven't moved the volume of patients. So we've been tracking our census over the last several Sundays because that's the day we're moving, just to see where that's at. If our census would be replicated from the previous Sunday, it would be right around 100 patients that we'd be moving on the 19th. So we'll actually begin the move very early in the morning, taking advantage of a shift change. So we have can double up our staff, have them come a little bit early, and have the other shift stay a little bit later. Move our critical patients first. My objective throughout the whole process is to really make sure that it's a respectful move, a safe move for our patients, for our families. We have families that have been here for quite a while with their loved ones, and making sure that they're in the process involved, clear communication, communication for our staff as well, so they know what's going on.
Is there anything you need from the public on Sunday?
What we need for from the community on the day of the move is to really help us get the move complete without interference. We will be working with those family members to make sure that they know when they can arrive to show up. If you have loved ones in the facility, it shouldn't be a surprise. We would have communicated with them and let them know. We plan on having that move done on midday that Sunday.
Mason Quackenbush is the operational project manager for campus renewal at Gunderson Health System. Dr. Jeff Thompson is Gunderson's CEO. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis interviewed them about a new hospital wing at Gunderson's La Crosse campus. Patients and staff will move into the new wing this Sunday. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this and other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find extended interviews and photos. And if you'd like to comment on our program or have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. You can also find Newsmakers on Facebook, updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.